I, Patrick, a sinner, am a most uncultivated man and the least of all the faithful, and I am greatly despised by many.
The opening words there to St. Patrick's Confession, which he wrote 1,500 years ago. St. Patrick's World by Liam de Puer explores his life and times, and for the month that's in it, we've chosen it for our book club. Before our discussion, let's hear what these people think they know about our patron saint.
I actually can't remember anything about St. Patrick, like.
He got rid of all the snakes out of Ireland, of course.
He said Ireland would disappear someday into the sea.
I think I remember something about him being captured and he was taken away to be a slave for a certain period of time. I don't know for how long. It might have been in England.
Yeah, he was captured by Niall of the Nine Hostages, and my name's Niall. So when we were in primary school, everybody was like, oh, you're Niall of the Nine Hostages.
He came from Wales. He was a slave in Ireland. I think it was on Slieve Mish.
I remember people giving out saying he wasn't Irish for a while, saying that, oh, he came from Britain and he's not really Irish.
He went back to Wales and then he decided he would come back to Ireland to bring Christianity to the people of Ireland who were pagans at the time.
I remember him dressed in all green with a big funny hat.
He's like a bishop except with green clothing, I guess. That's how I always pictured him. And a big like pope-like hat, except it's green, with like a gold cross.
And he carried a crook. And I think that was because when he was a slave, he was a shepherd.
I imagine in reality he would look quite different. Yeah. He'd probably he'd be more rough around the edges and probably more malnourished considering the time in Ireland.
I'm not sure if he was a real person or not, but there was definitely a man who came to Ireland to preach Christianity.
Right, a dose of myth, legend and reality there as described to James Keating. I'm joined by Dr. Catherine Swift, the Director of Irish Studies with Mary Immaculate College at the University of Limerick, and Terry O'Hagan from the School of Archaeology at University College Dublin. Now, those people we just heard reflect what many of us think we know about St. Patrick. Were they largely accurate or were they completely off the mark? Terry.
Again, a whole range of material there. Nice to see some of the more stereotypical legendary stuff coming out, this Slemish location, the fact that he was a slave, the fact that he comes from what people consider Wales. It's not modern Wales in the modern sense. It would be a very old version of Welsh, insular British, really, would be the technical term for it. But yeah, it wasn't such a bad result.
But one of the things which is a bit sad in a way is the notion that we're so conscious of the legend that people are saying, one lady there said she didn't think he was a real man. I mean, one of the things about Patrick's writings is that they are so human. And in an era when most of what we know about religious men and women is propaganda, this is what he's writing is not propaganda. It's very heartfelt. And in a sense, he's the realest saint in the pantheon, almost, and certainly of the Irish saints, he's one of the most human that we have.
And has the image and legend changed much over the last 1,500 years, do you think?
There's layers and layers of myth and legend. I mean, one generation changes it for various reasons and another generation comes in. It's all tied up with political, ecclesiastical propaganda, Armagh going for primacy, secular dynasties. The Inéil made a mention there as well, the most powerful dynasty of Ulster, rising power from the 5th, 6th and 7th centuries, going for the kingship of Tara, the kingship of Brega. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about 600 feet worth of layers of
legend. So almost every generation has an agenda of some kind.
Absolutely. And still does, and to a certain extent we're shackled with an awful lot of a complete reworking of it going on from the 19th century, all tied in with Irish identity, ethnicity, nationalism, the whole idea of independent Ireland as well. Patrick is intimately tied up with that.
This is where the Shamrock came in, for example, the whole notion of the Shamrock and the Trinity and the talk that he gave or the sermon that he gave.
Well, the Trinity is very important to him. He's very keen to stress that he is a good Orthodox Catholic in a world where there's a lot of debates going on about the nature of the Trinity. So in that sense, the Shamrock idea is reflecting a real reality in the text. But the actual Shamrock itself, as opposed to the discussion of the Trinity, that's a modern nationalist myth and spread with the diaspora.
Okay, tell me a little bit about life in Ireland in the 5th century. What do we know about what Ireland looked like? What do we know about Irish society back in the 5th century?
Incredibly hierarchical. It's very much a lost century in terms of history. Patrick's writings are the only primary source we have for Ireland. Irish history starts, obviously, essentially with Patrick. It's the only primary document I think we have for Britain as well in the 5th century.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Ireland, in terms of landscape, would have been an awful lot wetter, an awful lot boggier. Forget about sort of the enclosed field systems we can see today. You're talking about an awful lot of open land. Mountains, rivers and streams would have been incredibly impassable due to seasons. You've got...
More forests, I presume,
an awful lot more forests as well. And even that horrible sort of in-between woods of forested, you know, underwoods and shrubs and sort of these really sort of really hard thickets and things like that. Obviously, the areas of clearance would have been used for farms. And socially and politically, it's a time of great change. It's the end of sort of the end of prehistory, the start of early medieval. The rise of these super dynasties is beginning to come in. And they're all taking advantage of a deteriorating security situation in Roman Britain.
And just in relation to how Ireland was governed in terms of legal structures, are we pre-Brehon laws at this stage, or were the Brehon laws have applied in Ireland in the 5th century, do we know?
The thing is, we're in a time of transition on the scholarship on that as well. The traditional idea in the mid-20th century was that Breton laws were written down maybe in the 7th and 8th centuries, but that they had a long ancestry and as oral documents, you know, recited around the fire. Nowadays, people are increasingly, since the work of people like Liam Brannock and so forth, they're increasingly saying, no, they're written down in a world which is conscious of the Old Testament, which is conscious of Roman law. There's concepts like natural law, which they're getting from Plato. It's an amalgam. It's still, you know, I mean, you can't imagine that in the 7th or 8th century, the rules for how to measure a ham, for example, changed very much. So there probably is a big prehistoric bit. But we're still, and unfortunately, we don't have enough people doing Old Irish, so we haven't got enough work done. But
Are we reliant, therefore, more on your field, Terry, on archaeology rather than history to tell us what we do know about the 5th century?
To a certain extent, yes, where we can find that archaeology. Again, it's very hit and miss in terms of archaeological stratigraphy. We have a big...
Ogham stones, that kind of stuff?
Ogham stones is probably the most exciting aspect of it. Ogham stones... It's based on the Latin alphabet. It's based on a Romano-British and European sort of fashion for memorialising the dead. Even when they're put on ancient sort of Bronze Age and Iron Age standing stones, obviously it comes in the 5th and 6th centuries, and I think a lot of them have crosses inscribed on them. Very much, an awful lot of them are found in ecclesiastical settings. They are moved there in the early medieval and later medieval period as well. To my mind, in terms of physical, you know, archaeology that you can touch, Ogham stones and Ogham inscriptions are probably one of the earliest archaeological evidence for Christianity.
And some of them have Latin names on them, which is really nice. I mean, there's ones in Carlo, for example, or Kerry, and they have names like Marianus and Sagittarius. So we actually see Romans, as it were, on Irish soil, which is really nice.
Which is theoretically, anyway, as far as they got. We might get around to talking about how far they did actually get. But let's talk a little bit then about Patrick and his early life. What would life have been like for the young Patrick in Roman Britain?
Okay, well, I know a lot of your audience and the people listening are interested in the modern period. Okay, so think France in the First World War. Okay, and people tend to think nowadays of people in the trenches. But actually, if you think about it, behind the trenches, there's a huge amount of English English people sort of supporting the army in France. And there's a huge amount of economic activity going on to actually keep people fed, however badly, in the trenches. Yeah. So that's what Roman Britain was like for 400 years. At least half of Roman Britain was being run for the occupying army. And economy and the structures of society were based around providing food and shelter for that army. Roman Britain had four legions, which was massive in comparison to most areas. It was right on the fringe of the Roman Empire, so it was very heavily, certainly up in Scotland and Wales, very heavily policed. Patrick lives in an era when those legions have suddenly gone, and they've been hauled out. At very short notice, really, to go and protect Ravenna and in Italy, and to a certain extent parts of France. So Britain is in chaos. It's like us in the crash. All the structures and the ways people made their living have suddenly died, and so Patrick
Although, in addition to the fact that there's no physical protection there anymore.
Exactly. And what's happening is that people like Patrick's family, who had actually worked with, I mean, he seems to be somebody who's from a... he's a Romano-British family, but he has strong British elements. He doesn't, for example, when he talks about his father and his grandfather, he doesn't name them in the Roman fashion. He names them in the Celtic or the insular fashion. He gives his father and his grandfather's name the same way as you get on the Ohm stones. But his family had worked with Roman authorities, and when the Roman authority disappeared, he's left, and he says himself at the beginning of the Confessio, "We deserved to be raided. We weren't, you know." He's really conscious that he's living in a world where the structures
they've begun to collapse.
His whole social life has begun to collapse, and he suffers from guilt. He's saying, "We did this to ourselves, because if we'd prayed more, then the legions wouldn't have left." And so forth.
And what do we know then about his captivity in Ireland? Sort of, I suppose you could call it 6 years a slave.
6 years a slave, indeed. Well, it's more than likely has nothing to do with Northeast Ireland. Unfortunately, the Slemish, the Antrim, the Armagh connections are a product of 7th century hagiography. He mentions only one other Irish place name other than his hometown, and that's Silva Foclutie. And that was in County Mayo on the west side of Killala Bay.
Father Joe Hogan texted us in to point that out. Thank you very much indeed for that.
I've done a little bit of work in terms of landscape around there. It's a fascinating area. So that's where he was a slave for 6 years. He was put to work tending flocks. He would have been out in all weathers. And yet at the same time, and with the whole slavery in movies and TV at the moment, I think it's a really sort of good time for people to think about slavery in 5th century Ireland. Just because you're a slave doesn't mean you're really, really out on the fringes of society. You're practically inside it as well. It would have been a fascinating position for him to observe for 6 years to the workings of inter Irish society.
And was obviously crucial later on when he came back. But what do we know about his escape from Ireland?
He says he started to get dreams. Patrick's very practical. I mean, there's nothing unbelievable about what he says. Everything that comes to him in dreams, he just reinterprets it, or visions of the night, as he said. He has dreams that he's going to return to his homeland. He doesn't really believe it. He keeps having them. And then eventually he somehow gets up the courage, runs away, crosses the whole entire width of Ireland. He sends 200 miles to a port, finds passage on a ship, is initially refused, and then is let on board and eventually escapes.
OK, let's hear this excerpt from Patrick's Confessio describing his dream, which ultimately led him to come back to Ireland.
Another time, after a few years, when I was in Britain, my family received me as a son and asked me whether, after such tribulations as I had undergone, they could trust me now as a son never to leave them again. But when I was there, in a night vision, I saw a man coming, as it were, from Ireland. His name was Victoricus, and he carried many letters, and he gave me one of them. I read the heading, "The Voice of the Irish." As I began the letter, I imagined in that moment that I heard the voice of those very people who were near the wood of Foclut, which is beside the Western Sea, and they cried out as with one voice, "We appeal to you, holy servant boy, to come and walk among us." I was pierced by great emotion and could not read on, and so I woke. Thank God that after many years, the Lord answered them according to their cry.
OK, why did he really come back, Cathy? Because presumably he was coming back. It was a great personal risk to himself.
OK, well, there are two different interpretations out there. OK, one is infinitely cynical. OK, and that is that his family belong to the class of Decurions. We know that his father and his grandfather were religious men, but they were also Decurions, which were basically the aristocracy who ran the towns. And there has been a theory published recently to say that the Decurions at this stage were being really soaked to pay the taxes to keep the army going in a time of invasions. And that by migrating to Ireland, he essentially
followed. So he was a tax evader.
He was a tax evader. Okay, that's the cynical interpretation.
Okay, that's an interesting one.
The less cynical
or
interpretation.
Or maybe he was a tax avoider. Sorry, let's just be careful.
Yeah, okay, very careful.
Alleged tax avoider.
Alleged tax avoider. The other thing is the other way of looking at it is in terms of a Patrick for the 21st century. He's somebody who comes, as I say, from this quite rich background in Britain, and he does. Religion, both for pagans and Christians in the 4th century, was very heavily dependent on dreams. And he takes on himself this vision to give up, to use his money, his family money, to go back and to work as an outcast in a land beyond the borders. And when he writes the Confessio in his old age, he spends a lot of time saying, I'm an exile. I'm a Roman citizen. I'm stuck here at the back of beyond. I'm surrounded by barbarians. I'm doing it willingly. I'm doing it for God. But I'm really homesick. And I'm always in contact. And in this way, he's very 21st century. I'm still in contact with home. I still know what's going on in the Roman Empire. But I'm out here beyond home and I'd love to go back.
Now, what methods does he actually use to achieve his objectives and to make conversions?
Well, first of all, he targets many people at different levels of society, from high to low status. He mentions the sons of chieftains, who he hires as royal bodyguards to accompany him. Patrick coming over a hill in 5th century Ireland would have been a very impressive sight, surrounded by men, looking very mean, with lots of sharp implements. He mentions female slaves. He mentions high-status noble women. Very much focused on women, which is not surprising, really. They're usually the best converts. They're far more better at religion than men usually are as well. He mentions protection payments to royal kings. He mentions moving about different jurisdictions, different territories.
So protection payments are basically to preserve his own bodily integrity, is that it?
Permission, yeah. If you're under the protection of a local king, right. Nobody else can touch you. And if you're passing from one territory into another, obviously setting up new fledgling communities as well, you want to have the local king on your side. And at one point he actually says that, you know, this worked in his favour because he was captured, he was, you know.
And would there have been objections on the part of the kings to this person coming in and trying to convert some of their subjects to Christianity?
I don't think so. I think, I mean, early, as far as we can tell from sort of sort of later classical versions of paganism, I would imagine that Christianity was just one more particular religion in there. Just one other interesting thing about it, I don't think any of the kings would have minded because Patrick pays an awful lot of money, wealth, the price of 15 men, as he calls it.
Kathy?
But the other thing is that the religion he's preaching is a pacifist religion in many ways. And in that sense, maybe some of the kings didn't like it, in the sense that although he operates in Irish society and he uses the Irish social structures like the retinue, the dov, he is saying to people, you know, murder is out, killing is out, warriorship is out. And to that extent, he is putting up a different ethos up against the norm.
I have a number of quickfire questions. There'll be a quickfire round at the end of this in the last minute. There's about four or five questions here, which are all very, very interesting questions. But the documents ascribed to St. Patrick, the Confessio, the Confessions, and the letter to the soldiers of Caroticus, can we be sure that they are genuine 5th century documents? Because there's a lot of material about St. Patrick's comes out in the 9th and 10th century and are essentially forgeries. Could these be forgeries as well?
I don't think so. They're nothing like classical Latin of the 3rd and 4th century. They look nothing like the Latin we can see from the 6th and 7th century. We are missing a gap, but it's exactly how Latin spoken in a vulgar argot through somebody who learned it late in his life through the medium of two other languages as well. It looks exactly the way it should. Yeah. Second thing about it is his use of the Bible. You were talking earlier before we came on air about just how much biblical references there are in there. The particular Bible that he uses, certainly for a lot of Old Testament references, and I think he references something almost two-thirds of the books of the Bible, the Bible he uses is the Septuagint. It was the one in use before the Vulgate by Jerome at the end of the 4th century. So whatever Bible he was sort of came up through that he had used, that he possibly even had, were certainly more old-fashioned. And as the Vulgate becomes into use throughout the rest of the 5th century, that would slowly get left behind. So he really is on the fringes between the old world and the new, between late antiquity and...
You agree with that, Kathy? You're nodding?
Yeah, no, I absolutely. And the you know, Absolutely.
Okay, right. let's do the quick fire round to finish off. What about Croagh Patrick? Does it have active connections to St. Patrick? And this is from Kevin in Guess Where, County Mayo.
Croagh Patrick is the Mount Sion of Ireland. Mm. It's Patrick as Moses, and it turns up in the 7th century. It is basically a replica of the story of how Moses got the tablets, except that in Mayo, he's surrounded not by black storm clouds, funnily enough, but by black clouds of birds that surround him.
Okay. Did he really banish the snakes from Ireland?
No.
No, right, okay. Easy one there. How many people did he convert in his lifetime? I mean, we don't really have a clue, do we?
He says many thousands, but the thousands in Latin could just mean lots and lots. It's the equivalent of us saying millions nowadays. Yeah. You
know? How did he die, Cathy, and what age was he?
He is said to have died at the age of Moses. We don't actually have any account of obviously in his own words. Sorry, that sounds really stupid, doesn't it? He writes the Confessio before he dies. He says this, but he probably died on the road with his boots on because that's the way he lived his mission.
Right, OK. We didn't have time, unfortunately, to discuss that wonderful book written by T.F. O'Reilly in, I think it was 1954, The Two Patricks, yeah?
But can I mention The St. Patrick's World by Liam de Puer, which the Four Courts Press has just brought out?
I was about to do that, but go ahead anyway. You've saved me the trouble.
OK. No, it's a fantastic... Mm. There are lots of books on St. Patrick, but this one is a really good account, which brings the... it's not good on Roman Britain, which I love, but on the other hand, it's very good on Roman France. And it brings a lot of primary sources together, and I really recommend anyone who's interested to read it.
And it is our book club choice for this month, St. Patrick's World by Liam de Puer, originally published in 93, now out of print. But to coincide with this programme, Four Courts Press have organised a limited edition reprint. It'll be available this week in all good local bookshops and online via fourcourtspress.ie. Details on our website, as well as more information about the item and a contemporary image of what a 5th century bishop would have looked like, or could have looked like, I suppose. Cathy Swift and Terry O'Wagan, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Our April book club choice is White Cargo, The Forgotten History of Britain's White Slaves in America by Don Jordan and Michael Walsh, which is published by Mainstream.